It's Wednesday, May 1st, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, an interesting job posting on the Amazon website. It's hiring a news editor to work for its doorbell company to produce crime news. I've got some questions for Mike and Ernest about that. No spoilers. We're going to talk about Avengers Endgame, the end of an era for Marvel Comics, but maybe a sign of some things to come for Hollywood blockbusters. And in the form of a question, who is James Holzhauer? He's got America talking about Jeopardy, but is he bad for the game? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with a statement from the New York Times after it ran an anti-Semitic cartoon in its international editions on Thursday. It depicts Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a dog on a leash held by a blind President Trump. To look at it is to be reminded of Nazi propaganda, the use of the color, of the imagery. How did this end up in print?
Well, basically ended up in print because the process is that they didn't follow the process that the New York Times had put in place, which is, you know, if you're going to take a cartoon, an editorial cartoon from a syndicated place, it needs to go through a vetting process. And at least what the New York Times is saying is that in its international edition, only one person pulled that, vetted it themselves, and then placed it in their edition there. And that's what led to the problems, because no one else actually saw it before it wound up in print. And so, but that doesn't excuse what they did and the fact that it took them so long to even acknowledge it, at least here in the United States.
Yeah, I'm not sure we really know exactly all that happened so far. I mean, it started out, it was a external syndicate, then it turned out it was a syndicate with ties to the New York Times. Who drew the cartoon? They weren't saying. Then it turned out it was a Portuguese cartoonist.
Who's working for?
Right. This one editor, we don't know who that editor is. We don't know if that editor is being fired, punished, you know, re-educated. We don't know what's going on there. And then, as Ernest said, the Times was, unfortunately, like a lot of folks these days, slow to respond appropriately.
Well, and slow to respond appropriately, this happened Thursday. People started talking about it, especially among those in the Trump administration who were very upset about it and the images that it put forth. And then Saturday afternoon, evening, there's the shooting at the Chabad in California, which brings to it another level and brings to the forefront again issues of anti-Semitism and growing hate speech here in this country, really putting more pressure on the New York Times to come forward with stronger statements and explanations.
Well, absolutely. I mean, their first statement basically was trying to explain, mm-hmm. instead of just saying, you know, we messed up, we're sorry for this, we're going to try to do better next time. They do the usual, try to explain away what happened. And then after everything that you just described happened on Saturday, they felt, okay, now we need to come out with a stronger statement. And, you know, by that time, you're already in crisis mode, but now you're in this mode of trying to play catch up, and it doesn't turn out well in the way in which they did it.
I will say that after they finally owned it, they really owned it. So
yeah,
there's
true.
An editorial yesterday, full-fledged editorial, putting it in context, not only apologizing, but talking about why it's so serious, given what's going on in the world today. I mean, one of their most prominent conservative columnists, Brett Stevens, wrote just a scorched, you know, editorial or a column saying how badly the New York Times behaved, and he said it checked so many anti-Semitic boxes that the only thing missing was a dollar sign. I mean, it was really rough. So that when they owned it, they finally did own it. And it's a good thing, because there are some people who believe, and if you read the comments, you'll even see this, that the New York Times just sort of did it deliberately, that they have an anti-Israel, anti-Zionist bias, and therefore it was easy for an editor to pick that cartoon and throw it out there without much control. I don't know that is true, but I do think they gave real ammunition to the Bush administration and others. The Trump administration and others who, you know, wanted an excuse to once again beat up the New York Times over this whole issue of Israel.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right in the fact that they did own it, that they have done the steps that they, at least if they'd have done it 24 hours earlier, they've done those steps. it does give the ammunition to the Trump administration and others to criticize the New York Times, and they're going to continue to do that. One of the other things I would say is that I think this also, in some ways, can help shape what the New York Times is going and others are going to do in terms of covering the open anti-Semitism that's going on right now. I mean, here we are, we're talking about another shooting that occurred in California after the shooting that occurred in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I mean, and how do you deal with this when you have current people in the administration, including the president, who aren't really forcefully dealing with this because they have the tools at their disposal to deal with it through the Justice Department, through the FBI, through other law enforcement means, and you aren't seeing that because many of the task force operations that were going on within the Justice Department have been dismantled that deals with these issues.
I do think that folks in the media, including reporters, columnists, cartoonists, do have to be free to be critical of the Israeli government or the Trump administration and not be always singled out for being anti-Semitic. But on the other hand, we've got to be careful not to let these obvious tropes, you know, right, enter into the picture when we are being critical.
Okay. So the president's position is clear. Ask him and he'll tell you it's the failing New York Times. We've maybe got some different thoughts on that, and so too does Warren Buffett. The multi-billionaire chair of Berkshire Hathaway told Yahoo Finance he thinks most newspapers are, well, hear it for yourself.
The world has changed hugely, and it did it gradually. It went from monopoly to franchise to competitive to
toast.
Toast.
Yeah, and soda's kind of like that too. I mean, they're still around, but that's a...
No, they're disappearing.
Right.
They're going to disappear.
Yeah, and so...
New York Times won't, the Washington Post won't, the Wall Street Journal won't.
So it's kind of an ominous view from a guy who has put some of his personal fortune into the idea of perpetuating local news that we're going to go by the wayside of sugary drinks that create and cause obesity.
I will point out, and your clip showed it, it was the interviewer from Yahoo News who used
the word
toast,
right,
and then he agreed with it. Nonetheless, his analysis is just as damning. And as you say, I mean, he owns a lot of newspapers. Now, it should also be said that, last year he turned over the actual day-to-day management of his papers to Lee Enterprises,
right,
which, you know, has been pretty guilty of slashing and burning at a lot of other publications.
Lee, the owner of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, for those regionally,
right,
who might be interested.
Right. But if you look at, you know, his analysis, I mean, there really is not much that we can do with advertising these days unless suddenly, miraculously, after all these years, newspapers are going to figure out how to compete, you know, with Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace or Nextdoor for local advertising. They've got to find ways for people to actually pay for news.
I mean, you know, we've talked about it on the show a lot in terms of what you just described, Mike, which is the failure on the part of local newspapers to be able to compete in that space when they had a monopoly. They allowed, I mean, not allowed, but Craigslist came in and basically took away their classified advertising, and now they've lost car ads to, you know, various other online entities, and those were the two, and then the demise of big box stores and malls are causing another ripple effect for that. I don't know at this point where they're going to go in terms of how do you build up or build back, and I don't think they're going to be able to build back the kind of competitive environment that they once had, or monopolistic environment that they once had, is probably the way to put it.
There's even a new player in town. I mean, I think a lot of folks in Columbia have probably seen the Nextdoor app. Some folks,
right,
have probably started using it.
Right.
It's not just that it's got local advertising, but there is community or neighborhood news. Now it's mostly, you know, a lost dog or whatever,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm,
there, some of the traditional news functions of the local newspaper are now appearing in competitive sites.
I mean, the one thing, you know, that Warren Buffett didn't talk about was the fact that you know, what happens to local news, because this is where, you know, the newspapers were where they were getting their local news. You were getting some of it on television, but not to the extent that you were getting in newspapers.
The depth and the impact.
The depth and the impact, and with
newspapers,
the willowing out of that, where are people going to go to get that news when that newspaper isn't there? I mean, I'm not sure if what Nextdoor and all these other sites are going to be able to fill that void, mainly because these are 1-3 man operations, and the local newspapers, you know, even though their staffs are declined, they still had people who were out there covering.
And I think of that too with a little bit of skepticism, to agree with you, Ernest, of that experiment that we saw in larger cities and a little bit in this area as well, maybe about 6-7 years ago with Patch and AOL's attempt to create hyper local news sites that were run by 1 or 2 people who were basically independent contractors working out of coffee shops, trying to really have that local, hyper local coverage. But the depth was never quite there. The audience engagement or interest was never quite there. And Patch just didn't make it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the issue that what we have right now when it comes to local news is how do you gather that news? How do you present that news to an audience in a way in which they're going to use it, and more and more people are getting their news from tablets and their cell phones, and how do you do that in a way that's going to make it profitable? And no one's really figured that out, which is why you have this disruption and this sort of hodgepodge going on right now in terms of the news media. And at some point, someone's going to figure that out, and when they do, then they could have a monopoly.
Well, and this isn't just a local issue. One of the organizations that we didn't hear Warren Buffett mention in there was Disney's ESPN, which just yesterday announced that it's going to cease publication of the flagship print magazine, ESPN the magazine. It's been on newsstands for 21 years and has been a staple for really good feature sports reporting. And it's saying now there isn't the audience for it, and it's going to cease the publication there.
I mean, for that publication, you could see it coming. And I think part of it was a lot of that, the information that was in there, a lot of the great stories that you talked about, the great photography that was in there, has all sort of migrated to online. The ESPN, over the course of the last year, and you could see it, has moved more and more of its content online. And when I say online, I'm talking more about its app. It's moved a lot of its content to its app. It's moved a lot of it behind paywalls as a way to sort of build that up. And I think they saw the magazine as, you know, in some ways competing against what they were trying to do in terms of the app.
I mean, and compared to some of the other examples we talked about today and in previous weeks, this isn't really signifying a weakness in ESPN's business strategy.
No.
I mean, I think they're being very smart in what they're doing. It is interesting to me that there is still going to be one more, at least, edition, the September edition, and they're going to bring it back as a specialty edition, and that's their body issue. Yeah. So what is that?
Which is the one that they get more hype from every year.
And it's their version or their way of competing with, you know, the swimsuit edition of, because it's naked athletes basically with strategically placed elbows and knees and
balls,
hockey sticks and balls and things like that. They're going to keep doing that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Not sure how I missed that one. Okay. So I just wasn't on my list of things to read. There might be a new player coming to disrupt digital news delivery. This one comes with a bit of a game of ding dong ditch. Amazon's doorbell company Ring is now seeking a news editor to cover breaking news and crime. So what we basically have here is a doorbell company that wants to take advantage of those built-in surveillance cameras to try and find instances of crime and then report on them. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, so before we talk about what could go wrong, I'm going to say something good about this.
Go for it,
Mike. Because it ties right
into
what we've just been
time.
Talking about. Here you have Amazon that's doing a very creative job of taking advantage of its vertical integration, right? It has speakers in your home. It has cameras now in your home and on your doorbells. It's integrated with all of its purchasing setup. And this is a great opportunity for them. I mean, remember how many years ago was it when the newspaper industry was vertically integrated, right? We had news and sports and weather and TV listings and cooking and entertainment and classified ads. That was vertical integration. Mm-hmm. That's what Amazon is able to do now. And it's kind of logical to say, let's create some quote news unquote about neighborhood crime, because that's going to solidify our connection with people in their homes.
I'm with you until you got to the crime part.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because I mean, if you take that the crime part out of the vertical equation that you just described, and say you put in what's happening in that neighborhood in terms of what people are doing in terms of their yards or in terms of home improvement, those kinds of things, that's a good thing. Crime, as we all know, we've talked about on this show, usually leads to the stereotyping and the biases of certain groups of people, and that's what it always leads to, you know, stranger danger,
right?
You know, and that's the problem I have with this in terms of going toward crime.
I'm with you, Ernest. I think about this in terms of how easy it has become, especially in local television news, to chase whatever crime happens because it's cheap and it's easy, and you can get a soundbite with the police department, and you can get the neighbor who says, "Oh, but they were always the sweetest person,"
right?
Or then you end up with "Well, they were always the ones who were giving beer to the teenagers, and that's why you saw that party on their doorbell cam." And I wonder if what it really does is leads to a misconception about crime rates and the prevalence of crimes in communities.
I mean, it's already there. When reading this, I was the first thing that popped into my mind, especially when you were talking about video,
right,
is someone running, you know, just happened to be running past your house, jogging, who happens to be, let's just say it, an African-American male.
With a hoodie?
Who's wearing a hoodie, who's running past your house, and you see it on your camera, and boom, you know, there you go. Somebody sends that the ring, puts something out, and then all of a sudden, there you've got this perception that there's some guy running through the neighborhood taking packages out when he may just be jogging and lives in the neighborhood.
It's going to happen. I mean, it happens already, as you say,
yeah, with
the way we cover TV news, for example. I mentioned Nextdoor. That's one of the other things you see on that site besides lost pets, is somebody suspicious was walking around our neighborhood today. Somebody looked, you know, knocked on my door, and when nobody answered, they ran off furtively or whatever, you know. Who knows what is really going on? And those kinds of mistakes will happen. But there is something to be said for people wanting information about their local neighborhoods. And if you can hook them into a news service by giving them crime information, playing off the fear, then maybe the next thing is something that is more useful. I don't know.
Oh, well, okay.
Maybe. It's going to happen one way
or
the other.
It's not often on this program that we look at each other and go, yeah, we're going to have to agree to disagree. I think we have one of those today. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree. Well, we talk, though, about how journalists are getting the information that they're getting and how they go about reporting out the stories that they do. We're starting to see something new, a bit more of a call for journalists to show their work, to be transparent about their processes and practices. It used to be that the public just took our word for it and our work stood on its own. Well, not so much anymore. And the Kansas City Star is one of more than a dozen newspapers owned by McClatchy that is trying a new approach to transparency. They're using this technology that they call background cards, where they're putting some information at the bottom of stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's one way for the reporter to basically, the reporter or reporters, depending mm-hmm. on the who's working on the story, to talk about, here's who I am, here's what I do, here's the way in which I went through doing this story. I mean, I think that there's something to that, and they're mainly doing it on big investigative pieces and that sort of thing. They haven't quite moved into the daily coverage part of it, and I think it's something that's good. The issue that I have with it is, are we talking about transparency, or are we talking about I just want to basically show that I don't have a bias here? And there's a difference there.
I mean, for the longest time, the culture in the newsrooms was trust us, right? And a lot of people did. Now they don't.
Yeah.
And so this notion that we ought to be more transparent, I think, is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think having the cards, or whatever you want to call it, is a good thing. But what's really different about McClatchy's commitment is that they're trying to build this into their content management system. For our listeners and viewers who aren't familiar with the jargon, you know, it's all the hardware and software behind the scenes that makes it possible to put out all the content that we see, read, hear, whatever. And if you can make it so that journalists don't have yet one more thing to have to write right. instead of going out and doing real reporting. If you can have your system make it more efficient to churn out this kind of information, then that helps everybody.
Yeah. I wonder how they do that, though, because some of the examples that were shown that you can see on the article that's on our links blog, it's kind of a paragraph, how we got the idea for this story mm-hmm. or who we talked to when we did this story, things like that. And I also then see that as another paragraph that needs to be written. It needs to be copy edited. That I still see that there would, you talk about not introducing too much more in terms of time or effort, but I think it still does do that in the sense that there's just one more thing added to that workflow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's one more thing that's added where, you know, that reporter could be out talking to another source to build out the story, add more context, things we talk about.
But if there's a graph or two that mm-hmm. you're inserting into your copy already to be more transparent about sources or methods or whatever, right. then if your system can pull that out and generate a separate piece without you having to go through all that extra formatting and effort, that's okay. And I should also say, I think we ought to give kudos to the folks at Arizona State, our colleagues there who've been working with McClatchy on this. Yes, the devil's in the details. They didn't describe exactly how this system works, but right. at least it's an effort in the right direction.
Right. Right.
Okay, well, Saturday night, the biggest names in journalism gathered in Washington, D.C. for the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. But the buildup from the past 2 years, it finally came to a head, and what was once a star-studded, celebrity-driven event had a brand new tone. Those who attended it described it as much more subdued. Is this a change that's for the better or for the worse?
We'll see. I mean, this is some, we talk about this
every year.
We talk about how, we've talked about how really it was one of those instances, one of those events, in which the journalists could come together with their sources in a way that was, some would say not
shady.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Some would be shady.
And I think it's moved away from that yeah. to a certain extent because you don't have the presence of the president there. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have that kind of vibe. And you have this sort of tension going on between the press and the executive branch right now, which is sort of giving them an opening mm-hmm. to maybe take the correspondence dinner back to where it was before you had all the pomp and circumstance and shadiness, shall we
yeah,
say.
It went from nerd prom, which was not so nerdy when people like the Kardashians are there, to truly becoming nerd prom.
Well, talking about transparency yeah. from the last story, the School of Journalism, we
benefits
have students
greatly.
In Washington
right.
who
mm-hmm.
benefit from scholarships
absolutely.
That they give. So we care about them doing right. well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I would say that, you know, we are back to the nerdiest of nerd proms and talking about real journalism issues for now. Let's just see what happens when there's another president back in the
yeah.
White House who's more press friendly and whether the Kardashians make their return or not.
Okay. Well, it was, I don't know, about this time last year that we were talking about Black Panther and you were schooling me, Ernest, in the ways of Marvel movies, reminding me to stay to the very end of the credits. I didn't see it in the theater, but I did eventually end up seeing Black Panther. This weekend, another one, bigger, blockbustier than Black Panther.
I know I said no more surprises, but I was really hoping to pull off one last one.
The world has changed. None of us can go back. All we can do is our best. And sometimes the best that we can do is to start over.
So I didn't see it this weekend. I'll likely end up seeing it eventually, but it seems like I'm in the minority worldwide. Ernest, you went.
I went. I was there. Saw the whole 3 hours of it. Loved it. Thought it was good. Way to end. You know, the whole Avengers quest, at least I think it's over. You never
know.
Well,
I don't know. Al Roker said on the Today Show on Monday that with the numbers of people and the dollars, and not just the dollars, the pounds, the RMB, the euros that were spent this weekend for this film, they'd almost have to be out of their minds not to come up with another way to, I don't know, have Avengers overtime if it's not Endgame.
I don't know how they do it, but no, that you're absolutely right. I mean,
from a business standpoint, how do you walk away?
I mean, there are ways in which they can pivot, and I'm sure that the powers that be at Marvel and Disney and all the others have figured out how to make that happen, but it's I think if you followed all the movies, gone all the way back to the first Iron Man back in 2008 to now, you're gonna come away going, okay, they did it right, but what's next?
I didn't see it. I've only seen the original Iron Man and Black Panther out of the entire Marvel universe.
Oh, good. So I feel less bad. You've only seen one.
I'm not that guy, but I was just obsessed with Game of Thrones and the episode this weekend. And I'll say it leads to an interesting conversation about spoilers in today's media environment. There are lots of folks who are worried sick about having these episodes spoiled, and it's so hard not to be spoiled now. There were 10 articles in the New York Times just about that Game of Thrones episode on their television page. There are all kinds of fan theories out there on every social media platform you're on. If you go to YouTube to watch something, it might pop up with a a spoiler on the side.
I mean, really, there were people who basically stayed off of their social media feeds
or muted feeds, to know.
So not to know, and you're absolutely right. So it's really gotten to the point where it's more from don't spoil the book for me now to don't spoil the movie for me to don't spoil the show for me, and so you don't know where it's gonna end, and eventually maybe it'll play out. You just don't know.
Okay, before we go, this last topic is gonna be have to be in the form of a question. Who is James Holzhauer?
You're at 71,114, and this is for you, Granny. Is your grandma still alive?
No.
You're gonna add some more money. You have just set a one-day record again, $131,127.
He'll be on Jeopardy again today. We're recording this program at 11:43. It's going to run on KBIA at 6:30, so we'll know if he's won another day at this point. When somebody runs away with it, is it good for the game or is it bad?
I don't know, it's kind of like the money balling of Jeopardy. I mean, this guy's got all these data techniques. He's a professional gambler. I mean, it's kind of fun to watch him break records, but it's not kind of fun to not have the old style Jeopardy where everybody who's good at trivia has a chance of winning.
Well, yeah, it's sort of after a while, the tide has already turned on him. I mean, there are people who are basically saying, okay, enough already. You know, why don't you just go ahead and lose so that we can get back to what the Jeopardy
that
we all know and love. Yeah, that sort of thing. I mean, it's almost like, okay, you're rigging the game. We all know you're rigging the game. We're tired of it. I wish that the producers or whoever's putting this out would rig it the other way.
Although on Monday, you only won by, 18 bucks?
18 bucks, 18 that's true. Bucks
and there's a piece on our links blog that you can go ahead and check out where talking to the guy who lost by $18 and his frustration. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also on iTunes and all the other places where you get your favorite podcasts. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJ AI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be back with you next week for another edition of Views of the News.